Good morning, everyone. This morning we're going to spend the morning talking about issues, ethical issues in international research. We have three wonderful speakers for you. To start the day, we're going to have a talk on international research ethical challenges in the field. And to present that to you is Dr. Elizabeth Higgs, who is with the International Research Ethics in the Era of Global Health Office in the NIAID at the NIH. And she's got a lot of experience around the world and is going to share some of those thoughts with you.
I think I can stand.
Yep, that's fine.
Thank you, Chris. It's a real pleasure to be back here today. I realized as I began to think about what I would like to say to this group this year that I'm getting old. And the good news is I think that there's a tremendous amount of progress in international research ethics, in the global health community. There's much more commitment. And when I reflect back on my own ethical path, I was the first bioethics major at University of Virginia back when people used to say, well, what is that exactly? So I think that it's an exciting time to be in global health research. And the ethical issues that we now face are very different than what we faced 5 years ago. And it's interesting to see them evolve. It doesn't mean that our responsibilities as researchers for all the past ethical issues have gone away. It just means that we're now facing a much more complex era with a lot more possibilities and more responsibility. So I am with the Division of Clinical Research at NIAID. But what I am going to say here today really are my own personal thoughts and don't necessarily reflect the thoughts of the NIAID. So just to give you an overview, so as I've articulated, I'm going to talk a little bit about how I think that the international research environment has changed. So, and I've sort of divided this into the pre- and post-global health era. It's sort of like I look at my life as pre-kids, post-kids. It's very different now that I have children. And I think our international research ethics are also very different now that everyone knows what global health is. That wasn't the case just 10 years ago and even 5 years ago. And so the players have changed. The actors on the stage of research ethics are quite different. It's much more complex. We've got I'm going to just show you that we have this much more cohesive community. And then I am going to go back to some of the fundamental ethical responsibilities of researchers. And in the past, I've talked about what I consider a practical approach. I mean, I'm not an ethicist, but I'm responsible for research ethics, just like I assume many of you are, and make some practical suggestions on how you just approach ethical issues in international research and now in your team of collaborators. So I'm going to make some assumptions right off the top here. The international research ethics describes moral issues in international research and provides guidance for all of us. And we have accepted norms, we have accepted guidelines, but they're interpreted differently, obviously, in different places. And international research, just by the fact that it's international, is inherently collaborative. That means that it's between two countries, two groups of researchers, and that various different types of research collaborations have different types of contributions from different parties, and we have different levels of responsibility, but we all collectively share moral responsibility for a project. So this is a pre-global health environment for international research. The usual source of funding, and this, again, is just going back, you know, 5-10 years ago, was government funding. The Medical Research Council in the UK, NIH R01s. We had very little industry involvement. The market wasn't there. As a consequence, there was IND sponsorship was very unusual. I'm talking about less developed countries, not Europe, but international research. Throughout the talk, when I'm referring to international research, I'm referring about research projects in less developed areas of the world. Those projects were usually bilateral. We've always, you know, in the past, I don't know how many years, Chris could tell us, going back, we've had IRB oversight, and we've had independent oversight from data safety and monitoring boards as part of ethical research. It was very scientifically driven. There wasn't a unified global health research agenda. There weren't goals put out there for the research community. People investigated what they thought was interesting and important. And there was little North-South dialogue on ethical issues. In fact, it was very difficult to find people who were trained in ethics in less developed countries. It was a new field for us, and it was even newer in the southern part of the world. So at that time, the researcher had the primary responsibility for the scientific quality and ethical aspects of the study design and conduct, and I see these sort of, I call them intrinsic to the research process. And we still do. I don't want to imply that we don't, but it was sort of the R01 investigator putting forth his or her project and, you know, having to defend it to the IRB, and with very little help from a sponsor or a regulatory agency. And there was also the guidances weren't quite as clear. There was shared oversight responsibility, and oversight was more challenging versus helping in the design and conduct that came from IRBs and DSMBs. And now the global health research environment, there really is a collective recognition that the health of global citizens is the responsibility of all, and we have targeted global health goals. And evidence of that, the Millennium Development Goals, that was signed by 189 nation states in 2000 for 8 specific goals, 3 of which were specific to health, to be met in 2015. In part, this is self-interested. I think the world has seen SARS spread rapidly across the globe. That's on the heels of that came the current H5N1 outbreaks in Southeast Asia, and real concern that and recognition that what happens in Southeast Asia affects us here in the U.S. XDR is TB is spreading. We've had our first case in the U.S. It's been out there for a little while, but now we're all aware of it because of a poor, unfortunate lawyer from Atlanta. And this is somewhat, I think the international health regulations, I'm not going to go into exactly what they are, but they're just a set of regulations to which all nation states are expected to comply to report things like SARS. It's not okay if you have an outbreak of, you know, a list of diseases, cholera, you know, XDR-TB, not to report those things. There's this obligation to the rest of the world. And there's just increased collaborations, multilateral collaborations. It's no longer just bilateral. We've got public-private partnerships such as Medicines for Malaria Venture, Gavi. We have increased funding for both treatment. So we have things like measles vaccines, and we not all the children in the world are vaccinated against measles, far from it. We know that clean water is helpful. So there's a big push in the area of implementation, but there's also a lot more funding for research with targeted goals. And a good example of that was the Gates Grand Challenge, where they got together some of the best thinkers in the world, and they said, you know, what do you think the obstacles to global health are? And they came up with, I think there's 7 of them, and then the Gates Foundation put money there and asked people to come in. And they asked for consortiums of people. They really promoted collaboration when they did this. We also have a Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, mostly, again, implementation versus research, but research money as well. So lots more money from multiple sources. And for those of you who are applying for NIH grants and the funding line is flat, that probably doesn't sound right, but it is actually true if you look at the total sums. There's also more industry interest, not surprisingly, as we are able to, as there's more commitment to put, for example, antiretroviral drugs into the developing world where the burden of AIDS is, you know, obviously we're spending a lot more money and therefore industry is more interested. It doesn't mean that they're universally interested. There are still global health research needs that could be met by industry that are not, but they have their economic realities to deal with as well. But we have more collective bargaining power. You've seen the prices of ARVs drop significantly just about every year. And we also have more acceptance of the issue of generic drugs, that when in the balance of things, we want to protect intellectual property, we want to allow drug companies to be successful, but we also want to save lives, and if we can create generic drugs which equally as efficacious, and you know, WHO created a process by which they would go in and say, yes, this drug is equivalent, and generic drugs have entered the market, and usually the big companies that produce those are in places like India, not necessarily the U.S. So just a little bit on the Millennium Development Goals. I wanted to highlight 4, 5, and 6 here, which target health specifically in terms of reduction of child mortality, maternal health, and specifically naming HIV, AIDS, and other diseases. Here's a little bit more specifics on the goals, and I want to show you that this is really happening. So we're midway between 2000 and 2015, and there was a report that came out. How are we doing? Well, we're really behind, and we can still achieve the goals as a global health community, but we have to do it in the context of accelerating resources and really stronger commitment. So there's really a galvanized community effort over this past year, a global community effort, to coordinate. There's leadership coming from all different sources. There's lists of contributors, including Gates and specific governments like Norway. There's public funding, private funding, and just 2 weeks ago, the Gates Foundation had got the malaria community together in Seattle, and then there was the Global Forum, an announcement that we can get rid of malaria, and we can get rid of malaria. We don't necessarily have all the tools, but we have some of the tools. We can certainly reduce it. So just 2 months ago, September 26th, this global business plan for health was put together by Tor Gadal, who's Norwegian, former director of TDR, WHO, and a researcher, a tropical disease researcher. And you can see that the basic concept here is that each country is going to have a health plan. And at the operational level, there's a partnership here between public, private, non-governmental organizations, and then there's all these different contributors, World Bank, UNICEF, WHO, governments, World Bank-type credits. Gavi is this public-private partnership. So bilateral donors, all these people contributing to this unified health plan, clearly putting, for us as a research community, the host country government squarely, you know, responsible for the health of their people with support from the whole global health community. I love the way he illustrated this too. I think it's lovely. Anyway, you can read the whole paper if you go to the website and Google Tor Gadal, but it's really, I think, a step in the positive direction that the countries themselves are not being acted upon, but they're full participants. So this, I think, is the model of where we are today and the environment in which we're conducting international research. So we've always had the researchers, and we've always had subjects. And when I say researchers, I mean both U.S. and our foreign colleagues. But now I think the sponsors are more involved, not just industry, but sponsors who are primarily responsible for the research. If there's something that goes wrong with the study, the critics and the defense often go straight to the sponsor. That's certainly something that we're aware of at NIAID, and I think any funding agency is always aware of their responsibility. But I think it's been highlighted by a couple of cases I'll discuss as we go along. And the host country government and healthcare system is very part of it. And then in the backdrop here, there's this global health community who's setting out these goals, research goals, implementation goals, funding, driving this whole new type of collaboration and research. Another huge change, I think, is that I used to talk about this divide that we had. We just didn't have any ethicists in the South, and you know, the industrialized world would sit around and talk about what the ethical norms for international research should be, and it's just not the case anymore. Largely, you know, the work of the department here, the clinical bioethics department, Chris and Zeke really, you know, have led courses and Ridar Lee all over the world, and really engaged people and put together, you know, talked about cases and published cases and really facilitated dialogue. There's resources to allocate it to training programs. Very interestingly, not so long ago, I would say 6 years ago, we didn't really have any indirects for our foreign grants. And it was the AIDS activist community said, you know, this really isn't right. We need to support these foreign institutions. We expect them to have IRBs and they need research funding. Now, it's relative. This 8% is quite small compared to our average universities here in the U.S., but nonetheless, we went from having nothing to acknowledging the need to support the IRBs. So I would say, and I'll show you a couple examples, that our colleagues across the world are taking responsibility for research, and they are engaged in the dialogue. So the principal research team in this global health era, you know, now involves more parties. Beyond the researchers, the IRBs, we've got the sponsor, the research team, the host country, and the subject population. And I didn't emphasize that, but I think it's important that they're part of the dialogue about the ethical issues and take responsibility for some of them. But this broader research collaboration doesn't mitigate our responsibility as researchers for the ethical quality in the issues in the research. And to a large extent, we're still coming up with the scientific ideas, the scientific validity, the medical issues of whether equipoise exists or not are still really squarely in the lap of the researcher as the initiator. Even if there's something we're responding to, like a Millennium Development Goal or a Global Challenge Grant, we still have to come up with ethical research. So suggestions for practical approach. I'm sure that you've had lots and lots of basics in this course and probably have grown up with ethics in a way that I didn't. But you have to have this working knowledge of all the principles. You really need to know the norms and the codes and the guidelines. And it's very helpful to know the history of how they evolved and what happened when we didn't have. So I would really encourage you to continue to read on all these issues and learn the dialogue. And it's really important not to be intimidated. Just because somebody knows a word you don't know doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have can gather the moral understanding behind the issue. It's important to look for the moral issues and not, you know, not to have say something about your research and say, oh, well, gee, I didn't really think about that. And that comes from talking with your colleagues, as I'm going to articulate later, this research team that you have. You need to pull your resources and really brainstorm at the beginning. And then you need to apply the ethical principles and develop a rational thought process, because you're really going to need to defend your work over time. And it's very helpful to participate in the dialogue. I think it's less important than it used to be because we have so many more people involved in international research, but it's still really important if you have a unique perspective to get it out there. I have a lot of colleagues who feel that the GCP process and requirement is actually impeding research, and in and of itself has unethical components. And so, you know, they've published on this type of issue. I got a Christmas card from a researcher last year that had GCP written all over the stationery. Very interesting. And finally, you have to know when you need help. And that's the case in the clinic. You know, we have recently had a patient who didn't want to divulge his HIV status, and we really needed an ethics consult. And the same thing happens in international research. If you have a particularly vulnerable population, you're just not sure if research of any kind is going to be ethical, get two or three ethics consults and get them to write it down, get their opinions. So again, this is just side stress that there will be people challenging you, and you have to be able to come up with a well-articulated rationale. And this kind of course is a good antidote to intimidation, and it will happen. And I want to say that the moral principles and guidelines and norms help you build your rational thought process. And some of these issues become quite emotional, and you tend to react versus think through the process. So I want to just review a case. This one was actually published in 2002, and I was the program officer at the time for this particular grant. It was a grant, and it was an ongoing pathology study in Malawi of children who had succumbed to severe malaria. And the mortality for severe malaria is about 15%. And why they were actually dying really wasn't very clear. So it's a very, very important study, the only one of its kind. And the study had come up for renewal, an R01, and previously it hadn't, because of the ethical environment, it really, the thought was that it didn't need to be reviewed by an IRB. But by the time it came up for renewal, they said, well, it has to be reviewed by an IRB. So the U.S. IRB decided that they weren't comfortable with the level of disclosure in the consent. And the issue was that it's really important for the researchers to take a good look at the retina and look at the changes in the retina, which they thought might have prognostic value for children who were at risk for mortality in malaria. And they're actually now doing a prospective study because of the findings in this study, this collaborative group in Africa. But the Malawian IRB approved it. And so it was very interesting because it was a returning Malawian, one of the first bioethicists who went back as a bioethicist, I think Joseph trained in Germany. But he really defended the Malawian position, and it brought up a lot of issues. I mean, children's removing their eyes, the consent said that the children would look natural, that the antibody organs that were taken would be replaced, but it did not specifically say we're going to remove your child's eyeballs. And the Malawians thought that this would really convey a sense of surgery, and that they thought that this would really dissuade people from participating. And if you think about it, what is the difference between taking an eye versus taking part of the spleen? You know, it's organ material from a scientific perspective, but there's this emotional attachment. So he also brought up the issue of if there's a conflict between the local and the foreign IRB, you know, which IRB should take precedent. And this comes up all the time. He argued in this paper, which I reference here, that according to the principle of justice, that equals should be treated equally, and that the local ethics committee, if it met all of the regulations and requirements, should take precedent and certainly shouldn't be overruled by a U.S. IRB. At that time, there was a National Bioethics Advisory Committee to deal with some of these international research issues, and they argued that for this concept of equivalent protection, that if the host country had an IRB that was substantial and followed all the guidelines, the U.S. IRB could defer to them. And there is a process through AOHRP under an FWA where one institution can designate another IRB. as their IRB of record. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen very often. So when we do research, international search, and now that we're doing it with multiple partners, there are so many IRBs to go through. And it's very confusing. The study that we're doing right now in Southeast Asia, we have 7 IRBs that we have to go through. Another reason why you have to have this practical approach is that if you don't, you may have problems getting your work published, even if it's very good work, good research, important findings. One of our studies involved looking at Pasobasler TB, meaning smear-negative TB, and the standard at the time was, you diagnose TB through a smear, and that it wasn't really shown that Pasobasler, meaning smear-negative TB, contributed to the ongoing epidemiology in a community. Perhaps because it wasn't enough bacillus there, but it really had never been looked at. And Peter Small and his collaborators in Mexico developed a study to ask this question. It was an epidemiology study, and they did culture and they did sensitivities, but it wasn't in real time, sort of batched and then eventually reported to the Mexican authorities. And as it turned out at the end, individuals that had drug-resistant TB had a higher mortality, not necessarily an unexpected finding. But when they went to publish the study, they were told this was an unethical study. And this was a time when I got a call from Peter. I knew that I needed to call for help. So I called the ethics office, and they helped Peter address this issue in a letter to the editors. So it's also important to recognize that there are unique issues in the international research setting, and these are very predictable. And so it's sort of unexcusable, and I would say morally irresponsible, not to look at them. And clearly we're working in a lot of medically scarce areas, and the barriers to care there, sometimes they're not surmountable, other times we can overcome them. There's economic issues. We're working right now in Southeast Asia. And in some countries, if you have avian influenza, it's paid for, but if you have severe human influenza, it's not paid for. We're distributing HIV drugs worldwide. In a lot of cases, there's not the ability to diagnose known opportunistic infections or take care of inflammatory response issues that take place when you go on to antiretroviral therapy. The expertise is just missing. Access to drugs is a problem. Approvals of drugs, common drugs that we use every day that are standard of care sometimes in the U.S. are not necessarily approved in other countries. Supply is an issue. The drugs that we use all the time, vaccines that we use, influenza vaccine, there's just not enough coverage. And then there's transportation issues. So all these issues you need to think about when you're conducting a study or planning a study. A little bit about barriers to research in our Southeast Asia network. This is a multilateral collaboration. It's got WHO, Wellcome Trust, NIAID, 3 different countries in Southeast Asia. And it's really built on principles of transparency, data sharing, capacity building, very solid, well-grounded principles committed to GCP and following ethical guidelines. So we're currently conducting this study of high versus standard dose oseltamivir for severe human influenza, so it can be either avian or seasonal flu. Many of our subjects are going to ICUs. And many of the network hospitals do not cover hospital costs. Some of them don't cover them all. Some of them just only cover the AI cases, as I mentioned. The mortality for the disease in Indonesia is now 80%, 60% overall worldwide. We don't hear a lot about it in the media. The media comes, the media goes, but the cases continue. And there's also some despite the scientific commitment to sharing samples, within the Indonesian government, there was, at least for a period of time, a decision not to share samples, which made conducting the research challenging. So I think I forgot to mention. So Yeah, I didn't put it on the slide. So last March in Turkey, a group of experts from across the world got together and we discussed how we should treat avian influenza. Now, bear in mind that we have very little data. We have some case descriptions. Some people are giving steroids. You know, there's all these different approaches. But it was in those recommendations the issue of consideration of doubling the dose. You know, it was recommended that you consider that. So that brought up the issue of, you know, had our study lost equipoise? And we received this question from several of our IRBs. Was the study now, you know, unethical? Was one arm superior to the other? And even recently here, right here in NIAID, I had to defend why we're paying the hospital costs for these subjects, because NIH doesn't pay for care. NIH pays for research. But if we didn't pay for the care in some of these hospitals, then we wouldn't be able to conduct the research. But fortunately, we had planned for this. And it's very interesting that some of the hospitals within the network, there's in the ethical community, I'll talk a little bit about ancillary care in a few minutes, but there's a debate. Should we pay for medical issues that arise outside of the context of the research? If you're studying sexually transmitted diseases and somebody has a pneumonia, do you have an obligation to treat them? Well, in some of our hospitals, if you're a research subject, no matter what comes up, we're required to pay. And this is, you know, clearly it's an ethical issue. It's a practical issue. It's a struggle that we have on how to do this. If patients have been enrolled and have a false negative, should the cost be covered? I got a call in my office one day, and this quick view was falsely positive. Patient was enrolled. They should have stayed enrolled according to but there's some confusion of interpretation of the protocol. And the patient actually got kicked out of the ICU, sent home. No, unfortunately, we didn't, you know, and I did not anticipate that issue. And now I know we have a policy around it, but this is an issue that, as a research team, we didn't think of. But what happened to this patient was that he went from being sick enough to be in the ICU to just being home because he couldn't pay. So it's a good example of the barrier to care. So ancillary care, I just mentioned that which is not required to make a study scientifically valid or ensure safety or redress research injuries. In the pre-global health era, the resources just weren't there. And for a physician who's committed to the well-being of their patients, and patients are different than subjects, but we feel the same about them, we want to be able to help them, is very, very frustrating. And this frustration persists. But now, with so many more parties involved and so much more commitment from the global health community, we've got the potential to really address this issue. And I feel that this is just squarely right in the middle here in terms of who's responsible for this issue. It's the host government, it's the sponsor, it's the researcher, and it's also the community. I'm a little worried I'm running short on time here. I'll just briefly go over this case. Just in quick summary, this is also a few years ago. Nevirapine had just been shown to be effective for maternal child transmission, preventing transmission of HIV. And we had a study in Kenya where the researchers were actually studying maternal the impact of maternal immunity to parasites on their offspring. So nothing to do with HIV. But it was also known that the prevalence of HIV in perinatal clinics was about 30% at that time. And so we knew that if we, and this study had been reviewed by a study section at NIH, given a good score, reviewed by the local IRB, reviewed by the U.S. IRBs, and everybody approved it. And then when it came, you know, to fine points of developing the protocol and came to us here at NIAID, this issue is, well, what about this ancillary care issue? And this is back when I don't even think I knew the term for ancillary care, but clearly there was intervention that we could do as a sponsor that would save up to, you know, 10 to 20 babies from getting HIV. So at that point in time, again, it was a big discussion we had, you know, was a responsibility to provide that, and, you know, would NIAID do it? NIAID actually did come up with the funds, but there wasn't a process for it that wasn't easily done. It took effort. It took recognition of the issue and then moving forward. But in this global health era, you know, with all the allocation of resources, the commitment to preventing the transmission of HIV, the maternal child transmission, I mean, would an IRB today approve that protocol, even though it's completely unrelated to HIV? I'm not sure. And if you were on the IRB, would you approve that protocol? So vulnerable populations. So vulnerable populations are populations that may be compromised because of limited choices. Poverty just limits choices. I mean, women go into prostitution so that they can feed their children. Prisoners are an example of vulnerable populations. HIV orphans, food scarcity, migrant workers are often don't have rights in the country they stand, war refugees. And a good example of the ethical challenges that arise in vulnerable populations is the recent studies. This was 2004 of tenofovir for the prevention of HIV in high-risk populations. So the hypothesis is that this once-daily tenofovir, which is a long-acting nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, could prevent HIV acquisition in IV drug users, prostitutes. And there were 6 placebo-controlled studies that were planned around the world. The CDC was a sponsor for several of them, and FHI, which is a clinical research organization funded by the Gates Foundation, was responsible for the others. And it's very interesting that the CDC sponsor study and the IDU subjects was planned at a methadone clinic in Thailand. And there were 3 IRBs who approved it, but there was no community advisory board. The first study that was closed was the Cameroonian study in prostitutes, and it was stopped, interestingly, by the Cameroonian government. And I think this illustrates my previous point about who's taking moral responsibility for research. FHI eventually stopped their studies, citing worries about conduct. And I think this brings up another really important point. FHI is a clinical research organization. They're a good clinical research organization. We work with them to help prepare our sites to conduct GCP-level studies. So FHI knows how to conduct studies, and I don't know if the adequate preparations weren't done or if this was just a convenient reason to stop studies that were already being criticized in other places. The Thai activist community around, I don't know exactly what they call themselves, but the IDU representatives really charged that this was an unethical study, that a placebo was unethical because the appropriate intervention was clean needles, which is, you know, provision of clean needles is illegal in the U.S. and apparently also in Thailand. They also suggested, because the Thai laws are so harsh around substance abuse, that these subjects were placed at risk. They argued that they should have been involved from the very beginning in the planning stages of the study. And I think this the issue around the world, the activists around the world argued that the prostitutes were, that the only reason the studies were being done in these resource-poor countries were because it was cheaper, and that it really should have been done in places like the U.S., and that population was too vulnerable to be used. And the other point that was brought up, and they were pointing towards the sponsor, I think in this case probably Gates, given the large amount of funding for the studies, shouldn't there have been a guarantee of ARV therapy for seroconverters in ongoing sustainable way? So it's, again, it's really an interesting example of the difficulties of doing research in vulnerable populations, something that very well may have been useful. And I just came from IDSA last month, and they had a session on controversial topics, and they had a pro and a con, and they discussed this very issue. So cross-cultural differences, different perspectives on simple evaluations, pregnancy test in China, some studies that we did there. We were just basically treating people for schistosomiasis, single drug therapy, but we didn't want to give it to pregnant women. But doing a pregnancy test in China, if you're pregnant when you're not supposed to be, it can mean real problems for you as a woman. Every village has a list. The women who are fertile are on it, and they're taking their birth control, or they're not. And so these issues have implications. If you're found to be pregnant with your second child, there's possible implications for a forced abortion. So these studies, what seems like a simple test, we also had this problem in Egypt, a pregnancy test of, you know, a young unwed woman found to be pregnant in that society has real social implications. So developed countries have developed more established medical research than less developed countries. The research is often not adequately compensated, and so the problems that we have is that so many times our research colleagues will be doing research in the mornings, and then they'll have to leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go to their private clinic to support their research careers. And there's less independent research capacity in these countries, and so I think there's a real moral obligation that we now see in the global health era to build up that research capacity. And quite honestly, just 8 years ago, we would committed to build up research capacity, but it couldn't be a stated goal. Couldn't say that our goal in this RFA is to build research capacity. Now my whole division is, devoted to helping build research capacity. So things have really changed in this regard too, and I think largely because of ethical recognition of the right thing to do. We are also working just to address this first issue in developing the concept of full-time medical researchers. I know that in Peru, I worked with one of the universities there just to help them set up a system of assistant, associate, and full professor, and the tenure-tracked concept. In Mali, we spent a lot of time training PhDs and then worked with the Malian government so that they had positions to go back to, and I think that's just part of developing research capacity, and I think that's something we need to do when we plan research projects. So also, although we're growing up as a discipline of bioethics, we really need to be open to different cultural interpretation of accepted norms and principles. An example of this is the age of ability to provide autonomous consent in some African countries. It's 14 years old. In one of our Southeast Asian countries, I think it was 21. It was older than our age, because if they were still living in their parents' house, then it would be disrespectful not to get the parents' consent to participate in the study. So just being, we had real issues. Should we change the protocol for this one country? And so we have to be sensitive to these issues. And then finally, the less developed countries have less monetary resources to share in research benefits. Okay, that's an obvious statement, but it has real significant implications. For influenza vaccines, this has been a very interesting issue in the global health community. Clearly, we don't know when the next pandemic will take place. We're very concerned about the cases of H5N1 and that they might hit upon just the right mutation. The virus is always mutating. There's several clades out there now, and it's really important to constantly look at the virus, sequence the virus, see how it's changing, and see if it changes its virulent properties or its transmissibility, and also to do vaccine research. And we have a system at WHO, which until recently, all cases, if you had an H5 case in your country, in Indonesia, you couldn't really call it a case, even if your test was positive, until the WHO collaborating center said it was positive. I think there's six of them. So all these viruses were shipped to the collaboration centers, and the researchers at the collaboration centers would sequence them, study them, work on them for vaccines, but that database wasn't available to the scientific community. So you'd send your virus. I was doing a workshop in Indonesia, and I was asking them about the comparison of their animal viruses and their human viruses, you know, and the sequence differences. And they said, well, we don't know. So it's very interesting, sort of the communication that wasn't there. And they said, well, we have to send them out to document our cases, but we're not getting the information back. So this was a big dialogue in science and several, you know, lots of people speaking out on this issue. And some of these countries decided, well, we're just going to stop sending our viruses. We're not going to be able to, they're creating a vaccine that's potentially going to make a lot of money, and we're not going to be able to share in that benefit of the vaccine, and we're not going to be able to purchase that vaccine. And so those countries that were not sharing virus specimens at the World Health Assembly, I think it was last May, were really heavily criticized. And there was, it's interesting because there was a kind of assumption that the morally correct thing to do is to share these viruses. But the reciprocal responsibility towards those countries was an issue that the less developed countries wanted to be taken up. So it's been a very interesting dialogue to see how this has worked out. And I think the samples are now flowing again. But it really demonstrates that the global health community, along with the international health regulations, is, you know, feel that this is a moral responsibility to share viruses, and what responsibility we have in return is also interesting. WHO, by the way, has developed a stockpile of influenza drugs that could be used in a pandemic situations and allocated to different countries, but overall we still are woefully underprepared for a pandemic. We don't have enough drug or vaccine. So, approaching international health issues and ethical issues in the global health era in your international health projects, I think it's really important for the collaborative parties to meet, accept the shared mission of identifying the responsibility for the ethical issues. And it may be that you, as the scientist, you're the medical expert, you're the one who can really determine equipoise. Maybe you're the best suited to go through the literature and sort through standards of care and what the risks and benefits are. But the community maybe has a better understanding of what their vulnerabilities are and what the research what vulnerabilities might be exposed just by the process of research. So everybody has to come together to share this existing knowledge, identify knowledge gaps. Site assessments, I think, are really important. If we're committed to conducting GCP research, good quality research, collecting good quality data, we have to prepare our sites. That means it takes time, it takes money, it takes training, lots and lots of training. You've got to be aware of the literature and also aware of other research that's taking place in the area. And I think there's a lot of potential for synergy. Recently in Foreign Affairs, I think it was last January, Lori Garrett was really critical that we shouldn't just have like an influenza network and an AIDS network, and you know, we should work together. We should use our resources. We need to think economically. And I think we're moving in that direction. And certainly you've got to include community advisory boards or community leadership really early in the process. I mean, it was interesting that these IDU activists in Thailand said, you know, we saw the protocol after it'd been through three IRBs. We didn't have a chance to even have any input into making this better. So there's specifics, the moral issues, the traditional issues of all of the design issues I've talked about, understand the local standards of care. And that local standard of care, you have to know whether how that compares to standards of care in other countries. And you also have to know whether it's adequate. If you know there's a lot of resistance to the drugs that are being used for a pathogen like falciparum malaria, you need to make sure that you're giving, that you at least provide your study participants some kind of therapy that's going to be effective. Using the therapy you know is not effective is obviously not ethical. You got to know what the endemic diseases are, their incidence, their prevalence, how they might be taken care of, what the resources are, the local healthcare clinics. Beware of this issue of data policy gap that I just mentioned, that the standards of care and the data informing the policy could be outdated. Make a plan with your collaborators to review the research ahead of time. Again, ethical obstacles, think about them. I already shared with you one thing I didn't think about in our most recent study. You'll always be surprised, but try to be very creative and very creative about what the possible obstacles and problems might be. And recently, Welcome Trust in their Nuffield report really are encouraging people to think about what the ancillary care obligations are and consider including them in your budgets, and I think the time has come for that. And then you need to meet regularly to determine if you need to change your course. Is your research still ethical? Or is there recent publications that change the standard of care, change the equipoise, et cetera, et cetera. So in summary, it's a lot more complex, a lot more responsibility, shared among more parties. There's more resources, there's coordinated goals, and I think there's a lot more moral issues, which gives the ethicists a lot more dialogue to work out in the next 10 years. Our fundamental ethical responsibilities really haven't changed for the design and the conduct. I mean, and it's still, you need the practical approach. You have to know the basics in bioethics and the unique considerations in international research settings. Anticipate the issues and be prepared to defend your work. And don't be offended. Don't take it personally. If somebody says, you know, this data thing is just unethical, don't take it personally. Just whip out your well-thought-through rationale and hopefully that's written down on a piece of paper and articulated. Let's see. That's about it. Thank you. I think I went right up through my question time. So I'd be happy to take questions, too. I just don't want to throw the schedule off. None. Okay. Well, thank you for your attention.
Any questions? Comments? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Libby. The next speaker is going to speak to you about exploitation. A very centrally important concept to thinking about international research. And the speaker is Alan Wertheimer, who spoke to you a couple of weeks ago about coercion and undue inducement, so he's familiar. He's works in our department. We grabbed him from the University of Vermont a couple of years ago, and he's written the book on exploitation. Alan?
Okay. It doesn't follow that just because I've written a book on exploitation that everything you're about to hear is true. Okay. I think most of it is true, but you shouldn't assume that that's so. I'll begin with the usual disclaimer that the views don't represent the position or policy of NIH or Department of Health and Human Services. In fact, I think some of what I have to say is actually not accepted by some of my colleagues in the Department of Bioethics. We disagree about many of these ethical matters. But be careful. I mean, the fact that some people think that the fact that people disagree about ethical matters means that there's no right answer on those questions, but that doesn't follow, okay? We can talk about that at greater length. It does mean that not all of us can be correct, okay? And in fact, I mean, some of the views that I'm about to talk about, I'm not even sure that they represent my own settled views. I find myself constantly changing my mind about these things. Now, my approach, as you noted from the previous lecture, by the way, I did finally figure out what happened with that clip from The Godfather that I tried to show you. It didn't work. Next year, if you want to come back, I'll have the clip ready for you. I mean, my approach is going to be more philosophical. As Christine Grady noted, I mean, I've worked on the concept of exploitation. Certainly, the previous speaker knows 50 times or 100 times more about medical research than I do. I mean, my point is not to try to bring some of the standard principles, say, look, these are what the principles are, and this is what you've got to do. That's not my approach. I mean, my approach is to question what some of the received wisdom about some of these issues might be. And in doing that, my approach is also often, as I think was indicated in the previous talk, to stand back sometimes from the issues of research and the ethics of research, to look at other ethical contexts that arise and see what we can learn about the ethics of research from considering other contexts. And I think we can often learn a lot. And if I think today's talk has one general message, it's to avoid labels and rhetoric. I mean, the writings on exploitation in international research, many of which have a lot of value to them and certainly have raised important questions, but tend to think that you can resolve problems by labeling something. That's exploitation, sort of end of discussion. Okay, I don't think labels actually do that kind of work for us. I think we need to consider these issues more carefully. And here, just a general point before we get into exploitation. I mean, it's important to see that we have questions about what the rules of research require, and then there are questions about or disallow, and then questions about ethics. And it's important to make the distinction between regulations and ethics. I mean, a law regulation may allow for research that is unethical. I mean, we often may need to, if we want to do our work ethically, go beyond what's required by the regulation. Just because something's legal doesn't mean it's okay. Like, you know, talking on the cell phone when you're driving in a car is legal in many states, state of Vermont, but not always okay. On the other hand, just because a regulation or law might disallow research, may disallow research that is ethical. And just because it's illegal doesn't mean that it's necessarily wrong. It might mean you ought to comply with the rule, I mean, as long as the rule is there. But it does, I mean, we shouldn't assume that the rules actually always capture what's right and wrong. Now, you've probably been introduced, probably the first talk this semester or in this course to, you know, the NIH mantra of research ethics. I don't know, 7, 8, how many principles? I don't know, something like that, including social values, scientific validity, fair subject selection, favorable risk-benefit ratio, respecting the subject. I mean, it's interesting that now some people have really seized on the concept of exploitation and think that sort of non-exploitation is a kind of summary value that actually captures many of these more specific values. And so people will say, well, if research doesn't have social value, we're exploiting people when we use them for research, given that we're using them for no good end. Similarly with scientific validity, if our study doesn't have isn't appropriately scientifically rigorous, then we're using research subjects for no good purpose, because we're not going to be able to actually obtain generalizable knowledge from the research. And also with respect to the other principles, I'm not sure whether this view is correct. I would prefer at this point just to take a look at exploitation without thinking that. Exploitation is necessarily intimately related to all of these other values. It might stand to some extent alone. Let's talk about two cases, one of which is in the casebook for this course, the anthology for the course, that have given rise two claims about exploitation. One was these maternal-fetal transmission of HIV studies, where it had been established that a long course treatment, which involved the administration of AZT prior to for a period prior to birth, during the labor and delivery process, post labor and delivery, and so forth, very long process. It had been established that it was reasonably effective in reducing maternal-fetal transmission. The problem was that this long course treatment was completely unrealistic for many of the less developed societies with obviously severe problems of HIV and significant prevalence of HIVs. And so it was never going to be affordable. And also compliance with the regime was difficult. I mean, the medical infrastructure wasn't there to administer this long course treatment. And so investigators wanted to find out whether a short course treatment would be at least somewhat effective in reducing transmission. And what they wanted to do was to compare the efficacy of a short course treatment with no treatment at all, with placebo. Okay. Because it was thought that here was a case where running an active control trial or a superiority or non-inferiority was just not going to give the data that we want. I mean, everybody assumed that the short course treatment wasn't going to be as effective. What was needed was to find out whether it was at least somewhat effective, and that had to be, if you were going to find that out, it looked like the only way to find it out was to study it against a placebo. And note that in this case, the benefit from finding this out would be largely directed to developing societies. Okay. This wasn't a case, as some other cases are, of using subjects in developing societies for the benefit of people in more developed countries. This was a case of using people in developing countries for the sake of other people in developing countries. Nonetheless, the study, if the study were to be done, and it was done, it involved intentionally withholding known, established, efficacious treatment. Okay, so that's one study. Another study, and it's in some ways similar and in some ways different, was a trial called the Surfaxin trial. An American company, Discovery Pharmaceuticals, had developed a synthetic surfactant therapy. Other surfactant therapies were derived from animals. This was a synthetic surfactant, which was thought to be easier to manufacture and might have fewer adverse side effects than other surfactants that were available. The cost of surfactant therapy is for infants with respiratory distress syndrome is very, very high. Okay, and what Discovery Pharmaceuticals wanted to do was to do the research in a set of South American nations where the annual per capita health care expenditures were in the range of $60 to $140. Okay. They wanted to note that the target market for this surfactant therapy was going to be back in the developed countries, unlike the maternal-fetal transmission trials. The target market in this case was to find a surfactant that would be better for developed countries. They also wanted to do it as a placebo-controlled trial. It wasn't absolutely necessary that it be done that way, but that the data was, they thought, would be cleaner. They would need to use fewer subjects, and it would be cheaper. Okay. And what they argued was that, look, if we do it as a placebo-controlled trial, no infants are going to be denied a therapy that was otherwise available to them. For the standard in the places that they wanted to do this work as a placebo-controlled trial was that infants with respiratory distress syndrome would get nothing. Okay. In the face of criticism, by the way, that study was not done, unlike the previous study. It wasn't done in that way, actually. The surfaxin trial was, they did do research, but for the most part in developed countries, and did it as an active control trial against other surfactants that were already available. Now, with respect to these kinds of studies, the surfaxin trial and the maternal fetal transmission trial, as your readings note, they have been very vigorously criticized. You find in the literature the following kinds of claims. Unless the interventions being tested will actually be made available to the impoverished populations that are being used as research subjects, developed countries are simply exploiting them in order to quickly use the knowledge gained from the clinical trials for the developed countries' own benefit. By the way, this might be have true for the surfaxin trial. Note that this is not actually factually true for the short course trial. The placebo-controlled trials are exploitative of poor people who are being manipulated into serving the interests of those who live in wealthy nations. If the knowledge gained from the research in such a country is used primarily for the benefit of populations that can afford the tested product, the research may rightly be characterized as exploitative and therefore unethical. If the results, Crouch and Aris, John Aris, I think, was here last week, was he not? If the results of a clinical trial are not made reasonably available in a timely manner to study participants and other inhabitants of a host country, the researchers might be justly accused of exploiting poor, undereducated subjects for the benefit of more affluent populations of the sponsoring countries. Now, it's important to note a couple of things. One is that it's not clear from these statements who the authors think are actually being exploited. Is it the exploitation of the country because the benefits would not be available to the country in which the research is done? Or is it the exploitation of the subjects themselves? Are the subjects themselves being treated unfairly? Note there is an interesting assumption. It's amazing that one, as a philosopher, that I get paid to do this, but I do. I mean, I'm spending a lot of my time thinking about the following question. I mean, think on the one hand about the infants that might have been involved in the surfaxin trial had it been conducted, okay? And think about all the other infants in, let's say, Bolivia or Ecuador or some other nation that weren't involved in the trial at all. We worry a lot, and it's sort of interesting, and this may be actually correct. I'm not taking a view on it. But I just want to note and ask and have you note that we worry a lot about the welfare of the people involved in the trial. We don't worry as researchers and as questions of research ethics nearly as much or at all about people that aren't involved in the trial. Okay? I mean, they're sort of off our ethical radar screen. It's a point that I will come back to. What I see going on in the kinds of claims that we've just gone through is something like the following argument. Proposition one, if a practice is exploitative, it should not be permitted. That's sort of the general assumption. If it's exploitative, that's good reason not to allow it. Then the second claim is a placebo-controlled trial, such as the maternal-fetal transmission trials or the surfaxin trial, are exploitative. That's the claim. They actually are exploitative. And when you combine the first two claims, then you get to the result that if claim one is true and claim two is true, then placebo-controlled trials such as the surfaxin trial or the maternal-fetal transmission trial, when you have known effective therapies and they're intentionally withheld from, let's say, half of the subjects, that those kinds of trials should not be permitted. Now, two points. One is, before we can accept the first premise with respect to, before we can accept the second premise with respect to some trial, such as the surfaxin trial, we need to say a little bit more about what counts as being exploited. What makes that true? Why is it exploitative? I think it may well be exploited, but we have to be a little more careful before we jump to the conclusion that they are exploited. But one of the things that I want to concentrate on today with you is that I think the first claim is not as obvious as many people think it is. That it doesn't quite follow that if something is exploitative, that it should not be permitted. And I'm going to suggest that we might want to reject the first claim, even though it has a certain kind of intuitive appeal. Well, what is exploitation? I mean, we can say at the most general level that A exploits B. I said A and B would make a reappearance when A takes unfair advantage of B. I think that's true. I think it's a good general account of exploitation. Unfortunately, it's really quite vacuous as it is. It doesn't really tell us very much. It is important to see that exploitation is a very specific form of wrongdoing. I mean, there are other kinds of ways of wronging people that have nothing to do with exploitation. We discriminate against somebody by, let's say, not consider hiring for them for a job because of their race or their ethnicity or their sex. We're wronging them, but we're not exploiting them, and we're not exploiting them because we're not interacting with them. We're not using them. We may abuse somebody without exploiting them, because to exploit somebody is to benefit from our use of a person, and if we don't benefit from them, we're not exploiting. I mean, abuse could be even more wrong in many cases than exploitation, as might discrimination. Paternalism is another kind of wrong, or might be another kind of wrong, that has nothing to do with exploitation. I mean, we might do something for somebody else's good, and we may be wrong to do that if they don't want it done to them. But we're not exploiting them in the process. What I want to particularly note today is exploitation versus neglect. I mean, sometimes we do something wrong when we don't interact with somebody, okay? And that not interacting with someone is often, I think, worse than interacting with them, even in a way that exploits them. That's a exploitation has driven me into something that I had really never thought much about before, which is what I'm sort of calling, for want of a better term, comparative morality, trying to figure out what things are more wrong than something else, okay? And I'm now attracted to the view that, at least in a certain range of context, neglecting people might be worse than actually exploiting. Well, to make a little progress on the concept of exploitation, let me use some examples. And I'm now going to throw up on the next two slides 7 examples of cases where we might think that somebody's exploiting somebody. My case called Nazis, that a Nazi medical scientist wishes to discover how long a person can live in freezing water, and puts B, who has been placed in a death camp in freezing water, and B dies within an hour. Exploiting. Kidneys. This is a process which is often discussed with the language of exploitation. A, who is affluent, offers to pay B $25,000 for one of his kidneys for purposes of transplantation. B, who is poor, agrees in order to provide for his family. Somebody says, look, A's exploiting B in this case. A's taking unfair advantage of B. Or kind of ordinary, mundane case of just being, we might sometimes say, ripped off. Exploited in that way. B's car is in a snowbank. I'm from Vermont. Well, not originally, but 40 years is enough. B's car is in a snowbank on a rural road late at night. A stops and ascertains that it'll take him 2 minutes to pull B out. I mean, he's got a four-wheel drive, ropes, chains, all this stuff. He can just attach them, pull him out of the snowbank. A offers to pull him out for $200. Okay, actually, Vermonters don't do that, but you can imagine maybe in Maryland they might. And I say, oh, it's $100. I say, well, make it $200. Make it whatever. Okay, somebody might say, look, that's exploiting. You're taking unfair advantage of this poor guy who's in distress. Or psychotherapy. A psychotherapist proposes to his patient that they have sexual relations, and then patient who's infatuated with the therapist agrees. That's a candid case. We talk about that in the language of exploitation. That's sexual exploitation in psychotherapy. Or slavery is a form of exploitation. Or a case that I call domestic, where A hires hiring lawyer hires B, a recent immigrant, to take to I'm sorry, it's not to take claim, to clean her home for minimum wage, and B would otherwise be unemployed. Somebody might say, you know, paying minimum wage for that is really exploit. You're taking advantage of that person's situation. You really ought to treat them a little bit better than that. Or a case that I've called sweatshops. Where Nike hires unemployed people in Thailand. The employees work long hours for $1 per hour, which is considerably, by the way, above, let's assume, above the average wage there. So, I mean, Nike has lots of people who want to work there. Nonetheless, we often think that multinational
enterprises like Nike are exploiting people when they hire them for what are what we might consider to be inadequate wages, or have them work under what we consider to be unacceptable working conditions. Now, it's important to see, think back on these examples, that then, in my view, there are some fundamental differences among them. And that basically, it's a longer story than this, but for today's purpose, I'll make it a shorter story. I think they fall into two categories. What I'm going to call harmful and non-consensual exploitation, as opposed to what I will call mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation. Note that in some of the cases, Nazi, slavery, psychotherapy, it's the person who's exploited didn't agree to be exploited. Moreover, they're being harmed by the exploitation. But that it's at least arguable, I don't say this completely uncontroversial, but it's at least arguable that in the other cases, kidneys and rescue and domestic and sweatshop, that the person agreed to be exploited. They consented to the transaction. And if somebody offers to pull me, you know, out of a snowbank, okay, I'll pay. I mean, I'm consenting. Somebody agrees to work for low wages. The wages may be low, but they may be consenting to work for low wages. And it might be to their advantage to do so, given their other opportunities. They're not being harmed by the transaction. The transaction is actually advantageous to both parties, to the exploiter and to the exploitee. Okay. If I think the distinction between these two kinds of exploitations is of paramount important. Okay. The first kind of exploitation is probably, almost always at least, more wrong. But it's also sort of not particularly theoretically interesting. I mean, the problem with harmful and non-consensual exploitation is to stop it. It's obviously wrong to harm people and to harm them without their consent. The second kind of case presents actually some interesting theoretical issues. Okay. Is it so bad if people are exploited, if they benefit from being exploited, and if they consent to being exploited? That's a challenge to us, okay? And it's one I think that is worth thinking about. Well, when is a transaction unfair? If you're exploited, but you've agreed to be exploited, and you benefit from being exploited, what makes a transaction an unfair transaction? It's only exploitative if the transaction is unfair. Well, what makes it unfair? Some people say that it's unfair when A takes advantage of B's vulnerability. But I think that can't be right. It's not necessarily wrong to take advantage of somebody's vulnerability if you do it in a fair way. And so this is a case. Surgery. A proposes to amputate B's leg for a fair fee. And because B will die unless she agrees to the amputation, B authorizes that. So, I mean, is A taking advantage of B's vulnerability? In one sense, yes. Is there anything unfair or exploitative going on in this case? I don't think so. There's no exploitation. Even though B would not have chosen to do it were B not vulnerable. So if that's not a right account, then what is the right account? Well, some people think that transactions are unfair when A gains more than B from the transaction. People talk about disproportionate gains. Now, interestingly, I think that claim, that view is also false. Okay. This took me a while to come to, but I think what I have to say is correct on this, and it's somewhat counterintuitive. That is, consider a case what I call unfair surgery, that A proposes to amputate B's leg for 3 times his normal fee. And because B will die unless she agrees to the amputation and can't find another surgeon, B authorizes A to go ahead. Okay. Is that unfair? Think so? That exploitation in this case? I think we might say yes. I mean, A is exploiting B. But note, think about the gains from the transaction. Who's gaining more? Well, B is gaining her life. A is gaining some money. I mean, if you try to weigh up the gains in the transaction, it's not like the exploited person is gaining less than the exploiter. Actually, the exploitee is actually gaining more. Does that mean that there's no exploitation? No. I think there is exploitation in this case. What it does mean is that I think this proposition is true, that in an exploitative transaction, the weaker party typically gains more than the stronger party. Actually, that it's precisely because the stronger party doesn't gain that much that she can threaten to walk away from it. Says, you don't want my deal? All right, I'm out of here. It's because you stand, the exploitee gains so much from being exploited that the stronger party actually has this advantage. And so that doesn't tell me that it's not exploitation. What it tells me is that we need another account of exploitation. In my book on exploitation, I try to develop an account. The first claim here is, I think, just sort of tautologically true, that transactions are unfair when A gains more than A should gain, or when B gains less than B should gain. We need a theory of fair transactions. In my book, I try to develop a view about it. I'm not actually, I think it's actually wrong. There's us. I'm just going to assume, without giving you a kind of clear account of what makes a transaction unfair, that some unfair, that some transactions are unfair. Most of us really believe that. And I think it's true. I'm just not sure I can explain what makes it true. It is important in thinking about exploitation that we make another distinction. Some people think that whenever you take advantage of an unfair situation, that you've exploited a person. I think that's not true. I think we have to distinguish between taking advantage of B and taking unfair advantage of B and taking advantage of an unfairness to B, or perhaps B's unfortunate or unjust situation. Some people say that whenever you take advantage of people, of a situation that people are in, if that situation is unfair, that you're exploiting them. I don't think that's true. Consider my case that I've called unemployed lawyer. B has been unjustly fired. Let's assume that's true. He was making $150,000 as a lawyer. And A is a community college. A offers B a job teaching in a community college for $30,000. Note that A, in this case, is taking advantage of an unfairness to B. If B hadn't been unjustly fired, A wouldn't have been able to hire B. But it doesn't follow from that that A is exploiting B. I mean, it may be that given what A normally pays people, and this is the best it can do, within the context of a community college, this is a fair way. So I don't think that A is necessarily exploiting B in this case. It's taking advantage of the unfairness, but not taking unfair advantage of the unfairness. A is doing what A can do. So it doesn't follow that just because potential subjects, and this is important, let me just connect this up for a second, that it's unfair or unjust that they're in the situation that they're in, that taking advantage of the fact that they're in this unjust situation itself shows that they're being wrongfully exploited. They may be wrongfully exploited, but you can't just assume that because their present background situation is an unjust background situation, that people who transact with them are exploiting them. And so another important distinction, in my view, is the distinction between what we could call transactional injustice and background injustice. And it's sometimes what really is bothersome to us isn't the transaction itself when we think about it, but it's the fact that people are in that situation where it makes sense for them to enter into a transaction. I actually think this is partly the case with much of the thinking about don't want to go too far with this, but I think much of the opposition to the sale of bodily parts, such as kidneys, is really an objection to the fact that people are in these desperate situations. It's not the transaction itself that is so wrong. What really is so wrong is that it might be reasonable for people in this situation to actually do that. Okay? We need to keep in mind the distinction between moral objections to people's background situations and moral objections to the transaction. I talked about mutually advantageous and consensual transactions. Last week you had a discussion of consent, so I'm not going to pursue that here today. You've talked about that on a couple of occasions. So let me get to the summary of this part of the discussion before we go forward. That is to say, I want to suggest that there are cases of alleged exploitation where B would not have agreed under better or more just background conditions, but where B is making a voluntary, informed, and competent choice under the circumstances in which she finds herself. So I think actually in terms of the surfaxin trial and the maternal fetal transmission trial, I think the women involved probably found themselves in that situation. They wouldn't have agreed if their situation were more just or better. I mean, if there were surfactants available, nobody would agree to have their child participate in a placebo-controlled trial. Okay, but given their situation, B may be making a voluntary, nobody's threatening, informed, they might not necessarily be informed, they might not actually quite know, but might well know. I mean, I don't think we should assume that they're not informed, and competent choice under the circumstances in which she finds herself. The interesting problems about the ethically most interesting problems about exploitation in clinical research concern, in my view, these kinds of cases, where the people are better off, where they're consenting to it, but where they wouldn't have consented if their background situation hadn't been so unjust or desperate. Now, some people think that if a transaction is beneficial to both parties and is consensual, then it can't be wrongfully exploited. I disagree. I believe that if it's feasible for the stronger party to offer a fairer deal, then it acts wrongly in not doing so. Okay? I believe in my rescue case. It was feasible for a person to do the rescue for less money, and it would have been fairer had they done so. Okay. But even if I'm right that it is wrong to engage in mutually beneficial and consensual exploitation, it doesn't follow that we should seek to prevent such exploitation. That is a different question. It's important to distinguish between the claim that what somebody is doing is unethical and the claim that we ought to prohibit them from doing it. Okay. Here are some sort of examples of this distinction between unethical action and interference. Call it the Holocaust denier. Somebody wants to give a speech denying the Holocaust. Well, it's wrong to give such a speech, I think, given that it's false. And hurtful, both false and hurtful, and perhaps dangerous. Nonetheless, should we prohibit it? I think not. The fact that it's wrong doesn't mean that we should prohibit it. Or consider what I've called the bigoted parent's will. I mean, imagine a parent that finds out that one of his children is gay and says, all right, you were in my will before. Now that you've come out, I'm not leaving any money to you. I'm changing my will. Okay. Well, I think it would be wrong for the parent to do that. But it's also possible that we shouldn't prevent the parent from doing that. We might say, look, it's your money, and given that it's your money, you're entitled to do something with it, even if doing that is wrong. Some people think that sex preference abortions are wrong. Some people think that even if abortions are in general ethically permissible, that there's something, I'm not sure I agree with this, but that there's something ethically problematic about people having an abortion because they have found out that it's a boy and what they really want is a girl, or vice versa. That some people think that that changes the ethical character. I'm not going to go into that now. My point is that even if that's true, it doesn't follow that we should prevent a person from doing it. The ethics of interference with what people are doing is a different question than the ethics of what they're doing. Okay, and so what needs to be shown about some exploitative transactions isn't just that they're wrong. What we would need to show is that we should prohibit it because it's wrong. And so that raises the question of whether we should prohibit what I've called mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation. So if we have a situation where A is under no obligation to transact with B at all. I mean, nobody would have complained if Discovery Pharmaceuticals had said, we're going to do this study in the United States. Nobody would have complained. They're not under any obligation, we assume, to go to Bolivia to actually do the research there. Okay, right? And if they just said, we're going to do this as a superiority study in the United States, or a non-inferiority study, everyone said, okay, fine. Okay. So they're not under any obligation. And now let's assume that B gains from the transaction. As, by the way, I think we can assume in the surfactant trial that there's a sense in which, at least before the fact, ex ante, we sometimes say, here now infants have had a 50% chance of getting surfactant therapy, where before they had none. And even, by the way, the infants who got placebos, who would have gotten placebos had the trial been conducted, would probably have been better off. Because they would have been in a hospital and they would have received ventilation, where otherwise they would have received nothing. Okay, so let's assume that A is under no obligation to transact with B. B gains from the transaction with A. But let's assume that B consents to the transaction with A, or that the parent consents in this case. But let's also assume that it's unfair. It's exploitative because the gain to A is in some ways unfair. A should have done more than A did for B. Should we prohibit such transactions because they are unfair, because they are exploitative? Some might say no. What I've called the permitted exploitation principle says something like this, that given the non-ideal conditions in which people find themselves, that it's wrong to interfere with or seek to prevent transactions that are beneficial to the parties involved, that are worse for no one else, and to which the parties give appropriately robust consent. Even if the transaction would not have occurred under more just conditions, and even if the transaction itself is unfair, unjust, or exploitative, that this is true if intervention results in no transaction rather than a more fair transaction. I mean, sometimes we might prevent an unfair transaction. And actually, there are laws in the United States. We have, in contract law, there's a doctrine called unconscionable contracts, where the state says that certain kinds of contracts between people are not permissible because they are sort of exploitative. But the point of such laws is the assumption that if we tell the rescuer you can't charge $100 for that or $200 for that, that maybe what the rescuer will do will actually give the person a better deal. If they can't exploit them, it's not that they'll walk away. They'll actually engage in a more fair transaction. So if that's the point, I mean, I think there, no, the weaker party actually benefits from the interference in those cases. The more troublesome cases are when intervention results in no transaction. When Discovery Pharmaceutical says, look, if we're not permitted to do it this way, we're not going to do it as a superiority study in Bolivia. That would be crazy. Cost us too much. I can do it cheaper in the United States. Okay. If they walk away from the transaction. Okay. That actually presents, I think, a more interesting ethical conundrum. So now let's turn to clinical research, okay, and consider this argument again. Would something like the transaction, let's consider Proposition 2, would it actually be exploitative? It might be. It might be. I think we would need to come up with a better account of what it is that makes it exploitative, why it is unfair, given that they're under no obligations to do research at all. But it might be. Okay. Should we prevent it, however? Should we insist that it not go forward in its proposed form? I mean, if Discovery Pharmaceuticals says to the FDA or to whoever would have to certify a comparable trial with some IRB. I mean, if say, look, if you want us to do it that way, you want us to do it as a superiority or as an active controlled trial, a non-inferiority study. If we can't do it there, we'll just do it in the United States. Okay. Should we prevent it? Should we insist that it not go forward in its proposed form? That, I think, is a different question. Now, what one finds is that something like the Declaration of Helsinki actually, and it's been modified, and there are disagreements about how to best interpret it, but the point is that it seems to accept something which could be called the best proven care principle, that in any medical study, every patient, including those of a control group, if any, should be assured of the best proven diagnostic and therapeutic method. Now, there are disagreements. Do we mean best proven worldwide? Do we mean best proven that's available there, in which case that might be nothing? Okay. But I think best proven probably means best proven, and that would mean that the short course trial and the surfactant trial would both, I think, run afoul of that principle. And so if that principle were accepted, it seems like those trials, it looks like, would be impermissible. Well, I think we have to ask, does that principle help? Does it actually serve the people that it's designed to serve? It might. It seems to me such regulations sometimes might serve what we could call a race to the bottom. Imagine a pharmaceutical company that's considering doing research, or an institution that's considering doing research in a variety of countries, and it says, well, look, we can do it here. You'll be better off, given your background conditions, if we do it in this way. And some other country says, well, hey, look, you come here, we'll make you even a better deal. You don't even have to do as much for us as you would for them, okay? A kind of arms race to the bottom in this case, where countries are sort of competing to be the cheapest possible source of research. And a principle like the Helsinki principle might actually be useful in preventing such. Does it prevent, or it might prevent, a race to the bottom? But in the developing world, researchers may go elsewhere, it seems, if placebo-controlled trials such as the surfactant trial are disallowed. And that it's, in my view, it's an empirical question, not a moral question, as to whether disallowing placebo-controlled trials such as the surfactant trial or the short course trial actually help potential subjects or increases the welfare of persons in developing nations. If the point of the Helsinki regulation is to help people, I think it's a question that needs to be studied. Does it actually help the people that it's designed to help? It might. But I think it actually needs to be studied. Now, some have argued that it's not just a matter of how we treat the subjects in the study, that there are also issues about how we should treat the populations of the countries in which the studies are drawn. In which the studies are conducted. And so people from my department have been involved in a project developing what was once called the reasonable availability standard. It's now called the fair benefit standard. And that standard says something like this. It's that unless the interventions being tested will actually be made available to the impoverished populations that are being used as research subjects, developing countries are simply exploiting them in order to gain this knowledge. And if the results of the clinical trial are not made reasonably available in a timely manner to study participants and other inhabitants, the researchers might be accused of exploiting. So note that the argument here is that we can counter the exploitation if we make the results of the trial available. That was the old standard. This should actually say reasonable availability, not fair benefits. What some have now said is, look, it's not necessarily the case that what researchers have to do is make that particular product or intervention available to people in the host country. What you got, because first of all, they may say, look, we'd rather have something else. Okay? Or it might be too expensive to make that available. The argument is that research is permissible only if some kind of benefit, let's call it a fair benefit, let's leave it somewhat unspecified now, are made available not just to the subjects, but to people in those societies. So the argument is, if maybe Discovery Pharmaceuticals doesn't have to make surfaxin available if the trial is successful, but it's got to make some benefits available to the people of Bolivia, okay, if it does the study in Bolivia. Okay. Is that... So the general notion is that not only do we need to worry about the exploitation of subjects, but it's important that the people in the society, the fellow citizens, as it were, of the subjects, be treated in a fair way. Now, actually, I think that's an interesting idea, but it is subject to an objection. I mean, consider the following analogy. I mean, that if the running shoes produced, suppose somebody says the running shoes produced in Thailand are used primarily for the benefit of populations that can afford the running shoes, the production of such running shoes may rightly be characterized as exploitative and therefore unethical. So suppose that looks less persuasive to me. I mean, we don't think that the societies in which normal manufactured products are produced necessarily have to benefit from those products, or that the fellow citizens of the people who produce these products are owed anything. I mean, Nike may owe it to the workers to treat them fairly. But does Nike owe something to the other people of Thailand because it's benefiting and because people in this society are benefiting from its productivity? It's not obvious that we think that the answer is yes. It may be yes. I mean, I think we need to think about that question, but note that it's not obvious. Now, of course, somebody might say that the analogy doesn't work. I mean, that medical research is different than production of running shoes. And I think it may well be different. But I think if I'm right that we wouldn't accept the argument in this case, I actually think it's an interesting question. It's just typically unquestioned as to why the fellow citizens of people who participate in research have any kind of special claim, as opposed to the research subjects themselves. I mean, the fellow citizens haven't done anything unless they have been burdened. I mean, it is possible that the research not only uses the research subjects, but places burdens on the society. And if it does place burdens on the society, people in that society do, it seems to me, have a moral claim to be compensated for the burdens that they have accepted. But it's not clear that... I mean, many people think it is clear. I mean, and I could be just completely wrong about that. Okay? But it's just not obvious to me where the claim of fellow citizens comes in. It is widely accepted in bioethics. It is widely accepted. I mean, I'm a loner on this, okay? And I don't even know what my view actually ultimately is on this. All I'm saying is that it's not obvious to me why this is so. I'm putting that radical idea before you. I mean, it seems to me we have to ask some questions here. If it's wrong to ask subjects to participate if they may never benefit, as those who get the placebo are maybe will never benefit, does it become permissible just because their fellow citizens benefit? That doesn't seem to be right. I mean, if we're treating the subject wrongly, it doesn't make it okay to treat them wrongly just because other people will benefit. Okay. On the other hand, if it's not wrong to ask these people to participate, why is it necessary that their fellow citizens benefit? I mean, if we're treating the subjects themselves in an acceptable way, if we're treating them in an acceptable way, it's not clear to me why it's also necessary that their fellow citizens benefit. I mean, one thing that we need to ask about exploitation, something that I had said I was interested in comparative morality, is how bad exploitation is. I mean, I think exploitation is bad, so it's not a point that it's not bad. The question is, how bad is it? Okay. David Rothman, an important American scholar of medical ethics, says abject poverty is harsh enough without people having to bear the additional burdens of serving as research subjects. No, Note the premise there, bear the burdens of serving research. So if it's a burden to serve as a research subject, I mean, that seems correct. But what if it's a benefit to serve as a research subject? As it might be in the surfaction trial or the short course trial. Then it's not clear that Rothman's claim is obviously so. Interestingly, Joan Robinson was a Marxist, sort of socialist economist of the 20th century, British, okay? And I found this statement from her. This has nothing to do with research, okay? This had to do with just an ordinary economic exploitation. She said, as we see nowadays in Southeast Asia or the Caribbean, the misery of being exploited by capitalists is nothing compared to the misery of not being exploited at all. She said, look, I think exploitation is bad, you know, but it may be that the misery of being exploited is better than the misery of just being neglected. Okay. And if that's so, then we need to be concerned that worries about exploitation don't force ourselves into the kind of situation that that Robinson is describing here. I mean, let's compare the notion of being exploited with being neglected. Let me compare to one company, I mean, a hypothetical. So we say that Nike employs workers for a wage that is very low by American standards, but above average in country X, and some claim that Nike is exploiting workers in X. Let's assume that's true. In fact, let's assume that Nike is exploited. Now let's take another company, which I call Hikey. Hikey, another manufacturer of athletic shoes, wishes to avoid the criticism that it's exploiting workers. And so it builds a highly automated plant in the United States. It says, we can't compete with Nike, and we don't want to pay their kinds of wages. It's too much. Everybody's been beating up on Nike. We don't want to put up with that. So we're going to build a highly automated plant in the United States. Okay, we can compete with them that way. Okay. And so we're not going to country X or any other less developed country. No, we could ask, who's doing more for the people in country X in this case? Nike or Hikey? Well, I mean, there's a sense in which Nike may be exploiting them. But Hikey ain't doing nothing, okay, for people abroad, okay? And so, again, this is not a defense of what Nike is doing. It is to suggest that when we think about the wrongness of exploitation, I think we need to be a little more complex about it. Now, what some people have worried about is what I've called the problem of the double standard. So Lurie and Wolf say, residents of impoverished post-colonial countries, the majority of whom are people of color, must be protected from potential exploitation in research. Otherwise, the abominable state of healthcare in these countries can be used to justify studies that could never pass ethical muster in the sponsored country. There's no way that surfaction trial could have been conducted in the United States. Not as a placebo-controlled trial. It would never be approved, and you'd never get people to consent, even if it were approved, which it wouldn't have been. Okay. And so they're saying, look, we can't have studies in one country that have different standards than in other countries. Acceptance of this ethical relativism could result in widespread exploitation of vulnerable third world populations for research programs that could not be carried out in the sponsoring countries. Marcia Angel, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. So is there an ethical double standard going on? Suppose it were one's view. Look, I think it would be okay to do the surfaction trial in Bolivia as a placebo-controlled trial, but not in the United States. Are you accepting an ethical double standard? Okay. Well, maybe, but maybe not. We need to distinguish between the claim that there are that we're using different principles in different contexts, and the claim that what's really going on is that the same or a universal principle has different consequences when it's applied in different consequences. Let's just take the single principle of informed consent. Suppose you said, okay, we're going to run this principle of informed consent in Bolivia with the surfaxone trial and the principle of informed consent in the United States with a placebo-controlled surfaxone trial. Okay, I'm going to hold both trials subject to the same principle. It's legitimate if, but only if you can get informed consent. Well, it turns out that you could get informed consent in Bolivia, given the situation of people in Bolivia, but that you couldn't get informed consent in the United States, given that surfactant therapies were otherwise available. No parent is going to consent to it in the United States, not give informed consent to participate in any such study. So is there a double standard going on? Well, in one sense, yes, but in another sense, no. Note that the same principle, informed consent, is being applied. It's just that in different contexts, it has different results, okay? Is that ethically problematic? Well, maybe, but it's not clear that what's going on is a double standard in this case. I'm just about done, okay? This is my concern. That if ethical principles, like worries about exploitation, work, they work because they affect behavior. They affect what's actually going on. We need to know, I think, before we think that these are the right principles, we need to know how they actually affect behavior. We can't assume that good intentions and high-minded principles will actually achieve their goals. Here's an example of what I have in mind. The FAA once proposed requiring that infants be placed in a child restraint in airplanes in the United States. They argued that this would save lives. So if you had, it was once on the table, it was actually a proposal that if you had a one-year-old, I actually have a five-month-old grandson, so if my daughter is traveling with her son to visit us, under that rule, she would have to buy a ticket for my grandson and have him placed in a child seat and then inside the seat belt on the plane. Okay, now that was safer for infants than letting the parent hold the child in her lap. Okay, but interestingly, the FAA said, look, this is going to be safer for children. But the study suggested not so. It would have been safer for the children on the planes, but when you consider what the effect of that regulation was going to be, they said it was actually cost of life. Because what's going to happen? You require my daughter to buy an extra ticket. She might say, I'll drive. And a child in a seatbelt in a car, or even in a car seat in a car, is less safe than being held by the parent on a plane. Okay? You want to keep kids out of cars if you can. Okay? Okay? Not a safe place. Okay, for the mother. So when you actually consider the effect of this regulation, it was actually self-defeating. It was designed to help children, but it actually, the evidence suggests, it would hurt children. Okay, well, I think something like that is true for the ethics of research in general. I mean, we need to carefully consider what the effects of some of the principles that we endorse will actually be. And the answers sometimes are that they're just like we want them to be, but sometimes that things are counterintuitive. When we look more carefully, the effects actually end up undermining our goals. In any case, it's my view that we're not going to resolve questions about the justifiability of studies, such as the surfactant trial, by appeal to the derisive language of exploitation. It's exploitative. End of argument. Okay. I don't think that works. I think it's more complex, and we need resolve them by the rigorous examination of ethical arguments and by the painstaking study of the relevant data as to the effects of various policies and principles on people's lives. That's it. God, I thought I would annoy some people here. Nothing.
Dr. Wertheimer, just my comment on. I somewhat disagree with your analogy of the shoe factory. not having benefits to the society, because the wages that are paid to the workers in the shoe factory go into the country's economy. Therefore, it helps the economy, it helps that population. Same thing with bringing down unemployment. Unemployment is a major problem in a lot of these countries. So that it would seem to me that there is a benefit to the population, unlike the research subject who may not be getting paid at all. So you have that difference. Nonetheless, it seems to me that there is something most of us consider wrong when workers in a factory in a third world country are being paid 25 cents an hour, 50 cents an hour, and the executives in that company are being paid hundreds of millions of dollars. There's just something that most of us think is wrong about that, and there's exploitation there by almost anybody's definition, whether or not you want to use exploitation as the standard for determining whether something is permissible or not permissible. And that quotation from that economist about capitalism, exploitation being better than no exploitation at all by capitalists, I think also has to be countered by when capitalist exploitation results in damage to the environment that results in, you know, sickness and you know, poor ruined water, air, soil that causes all kinds of problems to the health of the population in that country. That is worse than no exploitation too. There's a lot of
so there's no doubt. I mean let me just I actually don't disagree with most of what you've said. I mean, if the transaction actually ends up harming people or harms people in the society, it seems to me that's an independent reason for objecting to what's going on. I mean, and so in the case that you described, I mean, if it's actually ultimately, when you consider everything, bad for the society, I mean, that seems to me probably close to a decisive strike against it, okay? The more troublesome case is where we think it is exploitative, but it's still, nonetheless, I mean, it's still beneficial, you know, and then we would prefer that it not be exploitative, but as I would, okay? I mean, I would prefer that the fellow pull somebody out of the snowbank for $10 than for $100 or $200. The question for us is, do we want to prevent them from pulling them out for that exorbitant fee? If that's going to result in saying, hey, otherwise I'm out of here, okay? If I'm in that situation, I'm saying, boy, I'd rather you didn't exploit me. But if you give me the choice between being exploited and not being pulled out, go ahead and exploit me, okay? And that to me is sort of the puzzle that I'm wrestling with.
Yeah, exactly. It is a dilemma because the example of the 50 cent or 25 cent an hour wage. Yeah, if we're not there, if our companies, Western companies, aren't there, they don't have a job. Period, and it's worse than a 25 cent an hour wage. Yeah. But it's still.
I'll leave aside views about how to calculate fair wages for across in other side. I don't have a well worked out. I don't have any view about that. But I mean, I take your point. Yeah.
It strikes me that both medical ethics, medical research ethics, and economic ethics would benefit by recognizing that serving as a research subject can be considered legitimately a job that you should be paid for, and consider the ethical implications as similar across working situations and research situations. You know, plenty of workers take jobs that are extremely risky, not understanding what the risks are, because they have no other opportunities, you know, whatever. You know, informed consent is a concept that would be quite beneficial in the job marketplace. And, you know, simply, you know, paying people to be research subjects when the risks have been carefully evaluated and carefully, you know, communicated to the participant, what's wrong with that?
This is, I think the expression is preaching to the choir. Is that? I mean, I'm very.
I don't know that I want to say there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but what I do want to say, and accept your general claim, is that I think there's a lot to be learned from bioethics in general and research ethics in particular in sort of opening up the framework in which we consider these questions. We tend to sort of focus in, on research, and research does present us with some unique kinds of issues. I mean, there's no doubt, okay? But when we think about the ethical principles involved, it's like we completely ignore the similarities between what's going on here and other human contexts, okay? And I think we have something to learn from those other contexts. I mean, you know, as my initial slide said, I'm a novice in bioethics. I mean, I taught political philosophy for my entire academic career. And I sort of come to a bioethics department, and one of the things that from the moment I stepped here, it's like I kept encountering this general assumption that it's special, that ethics here is different than in other contexts. Okay, and I kept saying, why? Maybe it is, but I'd like somebody to explain it to me. Okay, and I think the answer is that there are differences, and those differences are important, but they're not nearly as sharp as people think they are. So I actually think there is something to be learned from that. In fact, I think I had a slide in my talk about incentives on comparing research with other risky jobs. So I'm sympathetic to what you said.
Okay.
Thank you for coming back in. We're going to get started with our third lecture for today, but I just want to make two housekeeping type announcements. Please, if you want credits of any kind, make sure you turn in your evaluations before the end of the day. And secondly, next week, which is the last week of the course, believe it or not, we have a case discussion as part of the schedule. The case is available on the CD that you got the first class. So please print it out, read it, be ready to discuss it next week. So our third speaker for today is Seema Shah. She is an attorney, works in the Department of Bioethics jointly with the Division of AIDS and NAID. And she's going to talk about a number of different issues related to international research, including informed consent, fair benefits, and post-trial considerations. Seema?
Thank you, Christine. I'm glad to be here as part of what I think is a very thoughtful series of lectures that you've had, and I'm hoping to build on many of the things that you've already heard about. So last week, Christine Grady spoke about informed consent and the data that's been available on that. So I'm going to try and focus on some of the issues that are more related to the developing world. In addition, Alan Wertheimer spoke earlier today about exploitation and fair benefits to some extent. And so some of the issues that I speak about today will overlap with his. But one of my favorite law school professors used to say, repetition is the soul of pedagogy. And whenever she said that, she would always make certain to say it at least twice. So I think that the overlap that you'll see today will help you think about the issues in a different way. And I hope to bring out considerations that may not have been brought out by the earlier speakers. So, before I say anything, let me say that the opinions I express today are my own. They do not reflect any position or policy of the United States government. You've heard this before. To begin at the beginning, multinational research is essential to understanding and controlling diseases of global importance. But it's necessarily going to involve many inherent and complex ethical issues. And all of the issues that I discuss today are controversial issues. They're by no means settled. I'd like to present some of the relevant considerations, help you to think about them in a systematic way, but I don't intend to resolve them today. To make sure that we're all on the same page, the terminology I'll use today has to do with a research study that involves at least two countries. One would be the host country that pays, that sponsors the research and has the research in its country where it's situated. The other is the sponsor country, which pays for the research to be conducted. Research can also be conducted at multiple sites, but I'll try to focus in on the first method of thinking about multinational research just to make things a little clearer conceptually. Additionally, multinational research can differ with regard to why it's being conducted in a particular country. Sometimes it's being conducted there because the host country is the site where these problems occur. So there might be diseases such as malaria or sleeping sickness, which are in a particular country, and that's why you have to do the research there. Alternatively, what's been happening more and more is some notion of outsourcing, where people are going to other countries because there might be more participants there for the research, or it might be cheaper to do the research in those places. So what I'll talk about today is I'll start with some ideas about informed consent in the developing world and think about some concerns that are very specific to the developing world, but also have some application to informed consent in the U.S. Next, I'll talk about post-trial benefits to individual participants. And I think this is an area that you really haven't heard a lot about. There's a lot here, so I'll try to focus on this area. The next part of my talk will focus on benefits to communities, in particular, the reasonable availability of the trial intervention after the trial is conducted, and the idea of responsiveness to the health needs of the country in which the trial is conducted. Then I'll talk about an alternative that Alan mentioned briefly, the Fair Benefits Framework, and then we'll look at some challenges to the Fair Benefits Framework. So with regard to informed consent on research in the developing world, first I'll talk about how we might think about respecting autonomy in varying cultural contexts, and then some practical considerations with regard to informed consent. So obtaining informed consent in research really is a way to show respect for an individual subject's autonomy. And in some cultures, people argue that individual autonomy really has to be balanced against community interests in some way. Some have argued that in more community-centered societies, in fact, obtaining individual informed consent without first talking to other members of the community might even be disrespectful. In Mali, researchers have taken an interesting approach to informed consent that's a little bit different than the approach that we use here. They, instead of just approaching individuals first, a tiered method of informed consent was used. And this tiered model involves a stepwise process. The idea behind a tiered model, the tiered model they use, is they started by approaching the leaders of the community. Then they conducted group discussions with the heads of extended families. Then they led group discussions with the mothers of the children who would be involved in the study. And finally, they obtained consent from the individual families involved. Interestingly, with regard to pregnant women, when they enrolled pregnant women in studies, they first approached the mothers-in-law of the pregnant women to ask them. And the view here was that pregnant women were viewed as a particularly protected group in the society, and that the guardians of pregnant women, in some sense, were their mothers-in-law. And that's why researchers started by approaching mothers-in-law first. One of the issues with the tiered model of informed consent is it's difficult to know who should really be making these decisions. One major problem that we're all familiar with is that cultural claims are notoriously difficult to evaluate. For one thing, culture is not monolithic. Any given culture is comprised of various subcultures, various subgroups. There might even be disenfranchised minority populations whose views are not expressed in the broader culture. And cultural claims can also not have as much salience or may not have the same interpretation with any given individual within a society. Another issue is that people who are in power in a culture may have skewed or biased perspectives, or they may not see things as other people do in the culture. And so it may be problematic that they are the ones who generally control information about this culture. Finally, from the perspective of a researcher, one of the most difficult problems with regard to culture is that when you come from outside of a culture, it may not be clear how you can evaluate the cultural claims that you hear, and it may not be clear whom you should ask about those cultural claims. So one solution to thinking about cultural claims that's a little bit different than the tiered model is to look to empirical data for a relevant community and see what that says about people's preferences. In a study conducted in Uganda, it was a randomized study of anti-malarial treatments, 347 mothers who were giving parental consent were asked about their process in both regard to informed consent. And these mothers overwhelmingly reported that they made the decision about enrolling their child on their own. So what's interesting is that for these mothers, it seems like a tiered model of consent may not have been an appropriate way to address the decision about informed consent. Another model that's related to the tiered model that's frequently used is to engage in community discussions about the study, and I'll talk a good deal more about community engagement towards the end of my talk. But another point is that it might be good to engage with disenfranchised groups directly. In a community in South Africa called Vulindlela, the researchers were interested to do HIV prevention research, but they also knew that one of the major targets of their research would be sex workers. So in order to ensure that they were actually engaging with the concerns of that group, they interviewed various sex workers and asked them who were the leaders of their community and who they'd like to speak for them. And once they did that, they involved those sex workers in the advisory boards that they used for overseeing the research. But even in that case, what was ultimately involved was only individual consent for research participation. And these are slides that may be familiar to you from last week. This is an example of a community discussion in Rakai, Uganda, but an individual informed consent decision being made here. So another way of thinking about informed consent, or another facet of these issues in the developing world, is that there is a signature requirement within the federal regulations that doesn't translate so readily to certain contexts. The federal regulations require that research subjects sign the informed consent document. The requirement can only be waived in two circumstances. The first is when there's no other record of the subject's participation and the breach of confidentiality is a significant risk for research participation. The other type of category is when research is minimal risk and it doesn't involve procedures that would require a signature outside of the research context. So an example of the second category is research that's survey research, where people don't ordinarily sign off on a survey before completing it. In Uganda, one of the problems that arises with respect to the signature requirement is that some people have distrust or fear of providing signatures. So up to 25% of research subjects in one particular study had documented reluctance to sign informed consent forms. And there was some speculation that this may be because of a historical problem. It may have come from the fact that under Idi Amin's reign, being identified in documents, such as informed consent documents, could lead to punishment by the government. If it is the case that there really is some risk of confidentiality or some special concern about confidentiality, it seems that the federal regulations may permit waiver in certain cases. But there are also other problems with respect to signatures. Some cultures have differing views of signatures. For instance, some people have the view that once you've signed a document, that agreement is binding, and you therefore cannot withdraw from the research. But that conflicts with the important principle under the federal regulations that subjects always have a right to withdraw from the research. So that cultural understanding may lead to confusion that we really should be concerned about. Another type of view about informed consent is the view that verbal agreements are binding agreements. And asking for something more, like a signature, implies that you distrust somebody's word. And that can be a significant problem in certain contexts. The problem with the federal regulations here is that they're not flexible enough to allow waiver of the requirements for these types of concerns. Perhaps the federal regulations should permit waiver in these cases. Not completely. It seems like it's not allowed under the federal regulations as they stand. One way to think about how you might do this is if the investigator documented the consent process and then had an independent witness sign off that the consent process occurred, that may be a way to ensure the ethical protection of this research subject. But if it does happen that way, it seems that it should also be very clear to a subject that the oral consent process is really how you decide about enrollment in the study. To be clear, this is not suggesting that this is something permissible under the federal regulations now. I'm simply suggesting that this might be a way in which the federal regulations should be more flexible than they are. So another problem with regard to informed consent is how you might obtain informed consent in low literacy populations. In some populations, people may not be able to read or sign the informed consent document. And one of the ways in which investigators have dealt with this in various cases is sometimes they've used an X instead as a signature, or even a thumbprint in certain populations. But researchers have also really tried to think about using creative ways of disseminating information to people who don't typically take information in by reading it. In Bulawayo, South Africa, one of the approaches they used is they used community information sharing meetings, things that were completely separate from the consent discussion, but town hall type meetings, where people in the community engage with researchers and ask them questions about the research process. Another thing that they did was they created a flip chart with pictures that followed a woman through from the beginning informed consent discussion throughout her participation in the trial, so that before a subject decided whether or not to enroll in a trial, they could see or visualize what their participation would involve. In Rakai, Uganda, people have actually taken a very creative approach and have tried to communicate through theater. They put on a play describing the various aspects of research participation. Another approach that they took is they gave subjects tours of the lab so that they could explain why they needed to obtain blood from a particular subject and what would happen to the blood after they took it. And this was another way of helping research subjects understand what was really going to happen, even though they couldn't read the informed consent form. One interesting point is that these types of tools might be useful regardless of whether subjects can read, because it's clear that there are many deficiencies in subjects' ability to understand the very complex nature of informed consent documents today. Furthermore, researchers in Rakai also used the method of trying to think about analogies that worked for subjects. So when they described the process of randomization, which, as Christine Grady pointed out, is very difficult for subjects to understand, instead of using the example that we're all familiar with, the example of flipping a coin, they used the example of having a bag full of two different colors of beans and pulling out one bean and using that to decide which treatment a subject would receive. So there are also ways such as this in which which investigators should become culturally sensitive. So next I'd like to talk about something you haven't heard much about throughout the course, and that's the notion of post-trial access to benefits. This notion comes about because researchers develop relationships with research subjects who take on risks to contribute to generalizable knowledge. And when the research comes to an end, it isn't always the case that the participant's need for treatment comes to an end. It may, in fact, persist. So researchers may not want to be in the position of abandoning study participants altogether or making them worse off after the research is over. But this raises the question, what do researchers owe their participants after their participation in the study has ended? Is it that they would owe them the intervention given to them during the trial if it was beneficial, or whatever supplemental or ancillary care was provided throughout the trial that wasn't directly related to the intervention itself? And both of these questions are also questions about how long these obligations might extend. With regard to guidelines about post-trial access, one of the most famous is the World Medical Association's Declaration of Helsinki, which in 2000 stated, at the conclusion of the study, every patient entered into the study should be assured of access to the best proven prophylactic, diagnostic, and therapeutic methods identified by that study. This provision ran into a great deal of controversy. People were very concerned about what type of obligations might be required by such a statement and how long these obligations might extend. So in 2004, the Declaration of Helsinki was clarified in a manner that was still somewhat unclear. They stated that they reaffirmed their prior position, but in something that sounds a little bit inconsistent with the prior position. They now only required that researchers identify arrangements or mechanisms for post-trial access in the protocol that could then be reviewed by ethics committees. The National Bioethics Advisory Commission has also issued some guidance on this, which may be a little bit more helpful. In their report on ethical and policy issues in international research, they stated that researchers and sponsors in clinical trials should make reasonable, good faith efforts before the initiation of a trial to secure, at its conclusion, continued access for all participants to needed experimental interventions that have been proven effective for those participants. They also noted that although the details of the arrangements will depend on a number of factors, including but not limited to the results of the trial, research protocols should typically describe the duration, extent, and financing of such continued access. And when no arrangements have been negotiated, then there was a need for justification. So some of the problems with the guidance on post-trial access is that one of the distinctions that we might need to make is the difference between acute and chronic conditions. So acute conditions typically require short-term treatment and a relatively small expenditure of time and resources. It might just be a one-shot deal to provide an effective malaria vaccine to the control group in a study that tested a malaria vaccine. By contrast, when we think about chronic conditions, we're thinking about more long-term treatment, which could add up to a huge long-term financial and logistical commitment, which doesn't automatically rule it out, but it does raise the question of whether investigators should be required to provide HIV care for the rest of the participants' lives if you had a trial with participants who had HIV. In addition, there's also a question about supplementary care, the care that's provided that isn't really a part of the research, but that's provided to people because they need it and researchers are engaged in conducting research with them. With regard to this type of care, this could also be a huge use of resources. And in some cases, conditions that are unrelated to the trial participation may even be more likely to be chronic conditions, which may involve a longer commitment. Another problem with supplementary care is that the care may be completely unrelated to a researcher's training or focus. And what's also true for both interventions and supplementary care is that others may have this obligation as well. So there may be a joint obligation requiring partnership between ministries of health and local governments and researchers to provide this type of care if such an obligation exists. In thinking about some of the limitations of these guidelines, they provide very little guidance regarding these long-term, resource-intensive post-trial obligations. They don't really seem to distinguish between different types of obligations in that manner. They also fail to address the uncertainty that's really inherent in post-trial planning. It may be that funding sources change dramatically. In the past 10 years, funding sources for antiretroviral therapy in Africa has changed so dramatically. It used to be the case that people didn't have access to antiretroviral therapy, and now there are many funding sources through which people can obtain it. Additionally, political changes may happen dramatically. Over the course of a 5-year trial, the regime might change completely. So even if you had a guarantee from a local official when you started the trial, a different person who has antithetical views might be in place by the time your trial is finished. Finally, there may be scientific developments that change. So it may be that the intervention you tested is no longer the intervention that you'd want to give people after your trial is done. Additionally, even if there is provision for referral to the host country's system of treatment, the system may not be able to provide the same standard of care that was available in the trial. So that raises the question of whether there's an obligation to provide state-of-the-art care after the course of the trial. One problem with these kinds of obligations is that they may also create a disincentive to do research in resource-poor settings. So the problem with this is that if research is conducted only in places where post-trial care is available, this might deprive some of the poorest and most isolated countries opportunities to host research. To think about this a little bit more practically, the NIH issued guidance with respect to access to antiretroviral therapy. And this was issued in March of 2005, and it has a slightly more practical element. It applies to NIH-funded studies that conduct antiretroviral treatment trials in developing countries, and it specifically addresses the provision of antiretroviral therapy after the study. The guidance states that for antiretroviral treatment trials conducted in developing countries, the NIH expects investigators or contractors to address the provision of antiretroviral treatment to trial participants after their completion of the trial. The guidance notes that NIH's authority is limited, however, to supporting research and therefore does not extend to providing post-trial treatment. For this reason, applicants are expected to provide NIH program staff with identification of external sources for ART provision. And priority may be given to sites where sources have been identified for the provision of antiretroviral therapy. The guidance in doing this is attempting to strike a delicate balance between creating stringent requirements for researchers to ensure post-trial access and encouraging researchers to continue performing trials in countries that may have non-existent, ineffective, or poorly funded antiretroviral therapy programs. So we conducted a study, with Christine Grady and Stacey Elmer of our department to try and understand how this guidance was being implemented. When we conducted the study, we noted that many of the plans that were developed built on existing structures, such as programs funded by local governments, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, otherwise known as PEPFAR, the Global Fund, or some combination of those different funding structures. There were a few investigators that took creative solutions. So one investigator created a nonprofit organization that sold artwork from Zimbabwe in the United States and took those funds to provide subjects with antiretroviral treatment. Another study mentioned that they would solicit charitable donations from industrialists in the region in which they were conducting the study, and then would use those funds to provide antiretroviral therapy for people in the study after the trial was over. So now I'd like to move on to thinking about post-trial community benefits. And these are some of the ideas that Alan touched on. I'll try to sort of allude to his claims about exploitation, but I'll let him, his difficult conceptual work stand and try to raise some additional concerns. So many people have expressed concerns that research in developing countries may result in unfair advantage for the developed world and not sufficient advantage for the developing world. This leads us to consider the ethical implications of outsourcing. So just so you have an example in mind as we go through these considerations, if you can imagine a study proposed of expensive blood pressure medication, which would be performed in India, even though the country has no intention to market the drug anywhere except in the United States. One question is whether post-trial access for the participant community is a necessary ethical requirement. And there's at least some suggestion that it might be. If we think that that's the case, that suggests that this study is unethical. So there are two related protections that have been suggested to prevent exploitation of communities. And these are the notion of responsiveness of the research question to the health needs in the host country, and a separate but related idea, the reasonable availability of a successful intervention in the host country after the trial is completed. So with regard to responsiveness to health needs, SEOMS has this statement: before undertaking research in a population with limited resources, the sponsor and the investigator must make every effort to ensure that the research is responsive to the health needs and priorities of the population or the community in which it is to be carried out. And the Declaration of Helsinki has a similar statement, that medical research is only justified if there is a reasonable likelihood that the populations in which the research is carried out stand to benefit from the results of the research. And to be clear here, we're talking about benefit to the population, not the individual benefits that individual research subjects are receiving. The concern behind these is to prevent the exploitation of developing countries by developed countries, to prevent unfair advantage to be flowing in the wrong direction. But there are some important criticisms of a requirement such as this. One concern that people have raised is that this type of requirement may be somewhat paternalistic. For one thing, many of these guidance documents originated in more developed countries, and they purport to say something about developing countries to make a decision in advance, which may be somewhat paternalistic or presumptuous. In addition, developing countries may have very good reasons to conduct research that is not responsive to their health needs. One question that arises is whether we're saying that developing countries are not allowed to be altruistic to other nations. If a developing country wanted to conduct a trial that would help people who lived in another developing country, it appears that this requirement would stop that trial from continuing, let alone if a developing country had altruistic reasons for conducting trials that would have results for developed countries. Additionally, it may be an explicit policy choice to decide to do a trial that will provide needed expertise to do future, more relevant trials. So there may be a more long-term view of health needs that a country is taking in a particular case. As an example, in Thailand, there was a trial proposed of hepatitis A vaccines. The trial would not be responsive directly to Thailand's health needs. This intervention was not something that would be used in Thailand later. But the people who thought about doing this trial were very interested in doing HIV vaccine trials. That was something that was a very pressing consideration for them. So in order to build the capacity to do those trials, they were interested in doing hepatitis A trials. And that type of decision appears to be precluded by such a requirement. The related requirement I mentioned is the requirement of reasonable availability. So SEOMS has another statement, which is that as a general rule, the sponsoring agency should ensure that at the completion of successful testing, any product developed will be made reasonably available to the inhabitants of the underdeveloped country in which the research is carried out. So again, what we're looking at here is a concern about preventing exploitation, but there are some serious questions that arise. One is, what is the relevant time frame we're talking about with regard to reasonable availability? Certain interventions take many years to disseminate, even in the U.S. Even after studies about beta blockers were published, it took 17 years for beta blockers to be widely used. So there is a question about whether we're really taking the long view and saying that an intervention should be made reasonably available in 20 or 25 years. Another question is, who is the community receiving access? It isn't clear whether that community should be the participants in the trial, the village in which they live, the country in which they live, or the geographical region that they're from. This also takes a narrow view of benefits. The view is that the only benefit that matters with regard to research is the reasonable availability of the intervention. And I'll talk about this in greater detail in just a moment. But a final problem is that this type of requirement is simply not applicable to certain types of research. Phase 1 trials may test an intervention that will go on to later testing, and by the time it gets to phase 3 trial, it may be that the intervention is no longer proven to be effective. Observational studies don't test an intervention at all, and therefore don't have this requirement has nothing to say about them or what types of obligations people might have after doing studies such as those. So these requirements stem from some concerns about the situation of exploitation in developing countries. In developed countries, research generally aims to benefit the population in which it occurs. Transplanting this idea to the developing world may have some value in minimizing exploitation. But there may be valid reasons that countries in the developing world have to conduct research that does not benefit them in this particular way, but that benefits them in other ways. And this also relates to Alan's point that sometimes double standards are not inherently problematic. Sometimes there are reasons that we have asymmetries. In thinking about benefits more broadly, one proposal is the Fair Benefits Framework. And this is a framework that requires considering all benefits and risks of the trial and evaluating those in the context of community engagement and partnership. So the idea is that all potential benefits and risks would be evaluated to research participants and the general community both before and after a trial is conducted. Improving community risks and benefits is also another important component of this idea. The idea is that through engagement with the community and involvement of the community at all levels of decision-making in an uncoerced and transparent manner, you can start to think about benefits in a way that really matters to those people who are involved in the research and the community in which the research is situated. The Fair Benefits Framework is not without its critics. In particular, it's been criticized for requiring too little of researchers. Unlike the other types of requirements that we've mentioned, it doesn't necessarily state that a particular thing has to be in place substantively in order for research to be fair. So reasonable availability is not a requirement under the Fair Benefits Framework. Some also argue that developing countries may not always be in a good position to negotiate for a fair or reasonable allocation of benefits. So creating a system that requires on this kind of negotiation and engagement might lead some people to be short-shrifted. But it was intended to get away from the narrow view of benefits that was inherent in reasonable availability and responsiveness to health needs. There are many types of benefits of research that may be important, and there's some concern that the previous ways of thinking about research really neglected a broader view of benefits. Another challenge to the fair benefits framework is sort of a recurring theme. What counts as the community? How do you engage and incorporate minority or disenfranchised members of the community? And as I mentioned earlier in the talk, there are creative ways that people have taken to try and engage different members or different groups within the community. But there's no question that that is a considerable challenge. Another issue that arises that I think hasn't really been considered in the literature is that to truly engage in community benefits or to truly engage with the community, you have to spend a considerable amount of time in a particular community and commit to long-term work in one community. And for some people, this raises concerns about over-researched communities. You may not be familiar with this term, but the term over-researched communities is the idea that if researchers spend a lot of time in one particular place, there are certain harms that result. And the way that they describe this collection of harms is that the community is over-researched. So in thinking through what the potential harms of an over-researched community might be, it might be that if you spend a lot of time doing research in one community, your data is scientifically skewed. So you have a lot of data about a particular population that may be different from other populations in relevant ways, and that may limit the generalizability of your data. Another problem is that there are many benefits that adhere with research, including building health infrastructure or providing ancillary care or post-trial benefits. And if you're providing those benefits of research only to one community, other communities are going without, even though they may also be in need. Another problem is that burdens may be unfairly borne by the over-researched community, and this has been a particular concern of late. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the recent vaccine and microbicide trials that have been conducted in Africa. In particular, in South Africa, vaccine trials have had this result where people are concerned that members of the intervention arm have a higher risk of contracting HIV. It's still not clear whether that's the case. From what I understand, that's information that should be coming out shortly. But if it is the case, then there is a concern that people who are in these over-researched communities are bearing certain risks unfairly. But I think this neglects the issue. What is neglected in this discussion is that there are many potential benefits with regard to over-researched communities. For one thing, with regard to empirical data, members of one over-researched community in Rakai, Uganda, have described their experience with research as generally positive. In addition, through true community engagement, researchers can help a community based on what they think this community really needs. They can actually engage with the community to see what the needs are there and respond appropriately. So one interesting example is, again, in this community of Vulindlela, South Africa. In this community, the researchers spent a great deal of time building their infrastructure, learning to communicate with different members, finding ways to approach people who lived in isolated parts of the region. But what they also did was they started to ask questions of the community about what was really important to them. And one of the concerns that members of the community identified is that they had a huge orphan problem that they didn't know how to solve. In this community, certain populations have HIV rates of up to 25 or 30%. Because of this, there are many children who are left without parents, and it wasn't clear what it was the community should do with them. So the researchers were asked to try and engage with this problem, and the researchers actually thought to themselves that they lacked expertise in trying to figure out how you might deal with an orphan population. So what they did was they contacted various people who studied social work and social institutions that have been created to deal with orphans. And when they found someone who was willing to apply for a grant and who ultimately got the grant and to spend a summer in Vulindlela creating a system to deal with the orphan problem there that was very responsive to the context and the needs of the community. This is one way in which the researchers were able to help the community that was responsive, that was truly responsive to their needs. But it's not a way that could be done in a fly-by-night manner if you simply inserted your research into a place for a short time and left. It requires time, effort, and commitment that the community sees and respects. To create those kinds of partnerships, researchers may have to spend a considerable amount of time in a particular community. But when they do that, they run the risk of being called over-researchers, in a sense. So I think what I've tried to address here today is that ethical considerations regarding research in the developing world are operating in contexts with complex political, cultural, and practical dimensions. And there aren't easy answers, but there are certainly better or worse ways to be thinking about these issues. The point that I'd like to make is that it is critical to the ethical conduct of multinational research to think about benefits and burdens of research in a comprehensive fashion and to have community participation and partnership in developing and evaluating research. So that's all I have for you. I'd love to hear any questions that you might have for me. I know you've had a long day, so.
I got one question. It's doing research here, I've always been taught that the only thing you consider a benefit to the participant is a benefit that derives from the research intervention. You can't consider any of this ancillary stuff benefit. Mm-hmm. Seems to be just the opposite in the international arena. How do you reconcile this?
Right. That's a great question. So one issue is that sometimes what you're talking about here is IRBs are trying to fit research into the federal regulations and to think about benefits in their relation to risks. So when they're thinking about an individual participant's situation in research, that's when they really need to try and isolate the direct benefits that come from research and weigh those against the risks, the direct risks that that participant will face. So in that sense, thinking about ancillary care or community benefits might be something that would be inappropriate, some people think. But in the international research context, there's a question about whether you should do research in that place at all and how you should go about doing research there. So it's a question that almost precludes the questions about, or is separate from, the questions about the individual risk-benefit profile. And so when people are making that determination, then they consider broader things, such as ancillary care, or some sort of community benefits that may result from doing this research there. And I think the reason there's this distinction is there's a broader concern about exploitation of the developing world by the developed world. And that's what this type of broader consideration of benefits is meant to address or allay. So that's I think, what explains the distinction. I do think that there are some ways in which the distinction can be kept somewhat artificial. And in terms of how people think about research participation themselves, they do take into account things like ancillary care. So I do think that IRBs maybe haven't figured out the best way to really reflect the way that people make decisions about research. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much for your attention. Oh, was there one more? Sorry.
In some countries, women in particular have little, if no, rights at all, and the decision of whether or not to participate in a research study is going to be made by a community leader or a tribal chief or someone who's going to make the decision for the members of his community or tribe. How does NIH handle the issue of informed consent in that kind of situation in an NIH-funded or sponsored study?
That's a great question as well. So one thing that I think that's important is that sometimes people say that women don't have general participation or autonomy in a community, but that actually doesn't reflect what's happening on the ground. So the empirical research I mentioned in Rakai, Uganda, showed that the mothers there were really the ones making decisions about their children's research participation. So one thing that's important is that when you hear a claim like that, you should test it and ensure that it's actually accurate. And where it's not, it may not be as important to be concerned about that. But I think the way that it happens is NIH is constrained by the federal regulations and must obtain individual informed consent. So women who are enrolled in studies like those will still be asked for their consent to research participation. So one thing that happens is it's probably a conversation, if it's really the case that women aren't accustomed to making those kinds of decisions, it's a difficult conversation to have because there is an assumption of autonomy inherent in the conversation, the assumption that women have made decisions like this before and are able to do so then. So it may not be easy to have those conversations, and I think to some extent community engagement before you have those conversations is a way to get people used to the idea that this is how research will proceed. Did you have a follow-up to that? Right. It may be that you have to find a way to encourage the autonomy of women who aren't used to expressing it. So you may have to give them an easier way of opting out of the research or a more clear sense that they can withdraw from the research at any time if you're concerned that they're not really giving consent up front. Okay. Thank you very much.